Thank you, Hans-Georg. Actually, we missed figures, so now those who like figures are pleased. And now with Leslie even more. There is a process of migration, which is perfectly understandable. And I will assure you that we are going to finish before 5.30. So if you can make it, please wait to that. And Leslie Francis is professor of religions and education at the University of Warwick, UK. Since October 2012, he has been director of the Warwick Religions and Education Research Unit. His research in religious education has been shaped by links with practical and empirical theology and with the individual differences approach to psychology. I like to mention that Leslie's current research projects include investigating the spiritual influence of Christian ethos secondary education and assessing the distinctiveness of church schools and faith-based schools within both the state-maintained and independent sectors of education. Thank you, Leslie.
Prynhawn, croeso cynnesiannu bawb. I thought I'd start speaking to you in Welsh and to see whether that helps our communication at all. One of the interesting phenomena in conferences of this nature is the way in which people from different disciplines talk to each other, but don't always make the links between what it is the different disciplines are doing. So I'm going to ask for your patience a little bit. I am a social psychologist. I talk about quantitative research, as Hans-Georg has done, but I want, in the process of doing so, to make the assumption that some of the participants are not familiar with the language. And as part of the process, I would like to make more explicit what it is I have in mind when I do the kind of things I do in an academic community. The title of my paper is the title of a written formal scientific presentation. But what I plan to do is to talk to that presentation rather than to present all of the boring detail, although I will present some of the boring detail if I can. The title clearly is to do with freedom of religion, but really the interest is freedom of religious clothing and symbols as they appear in schools. And the question I want to take out of that is whether the type of school young people happen to be attending may have an impact on their attitude towards the presence of religious symbols and religious clothing. That's what it's about. And here is a machine that I'm trying to learn how to operate. So the context to what I'm doing. I want to give a slightly broader context before I start, and to introduce a bit of the ambition of the Warwick Religions and Education Research Unit, a unit set up in the last millennium by my good friend and colleague, Bob Jackson. Need to mention Bob's name. Someone who's concerned with ethnography. And when I'm invited to bring my research group to join his research group, we become a multi-method research group, ethnography complemented by a quantitative form of social psychology. The project on which I wish to draw for this presentation is a project known as the Young People's Attitude to Religious Diversity Project, a project set up by Bob Jackson as principal investigator, me as co-investigator, mixed method, ethnography and quantitative stuff. It became part of that great Linda Woodhead programme of religion and society that increased the infrastructure for research in religion just for a short space of time. When I was designing the Young People's Attitudes to Religious Diversity Project, I was also conscious that I was part of Hans-Georg's group, and I wanted to build into this project some questions that were relevant to the human rights agenda for the research programme that he's involved in. And one reason for thinking that might be a useful thing to do is that I was able to lower the age profile. You noticed Hans-Georg's presentation, 15 up. I'm on 13 to 15-year-olds. And sometimes it's useful to see whether things that may be shown to hold relationships of one age group hold them also among another. What I'm essentially interested in doing is getting hold of students' experiences, but doing so in a way that may be subject to scientific measurement. And it's that issue of scientific measurement that I want to give just a tiny piece of attention to before I go on to look at the data itself. I'm interested in building scales, just as we heard from the previous presentation, that a number of scales are used. But it may be just worth reflecting on what we're trying to do as social scientists when we build scales. I'm interested in attitudes towards religious clothing, so I can take examples of that. What do you think about seeing the cross in school? What do you think about the turban in school? What about the veil? But in a sense, all of those are opinions. They're one issue. But is there something underlying those disparate issues that we might actually be able to say is an underlying attitude? An attitude that is stable across religious clothings and can, if we look at a group of religious clothings, be said to predispose the young person in the attitude or the specific opinion. In another sense, the attitude is the underlying construct to which we're trying to gain access by looking at the opinions to which it gives rise. Now, there's a real advantage in trying to build things like scales to get to underlying constructs, because having done that, one can ask more intelligent questions, as Hans-Georg was doing, about the correlates, the consequences, the antecedents of individual differences in those underlying attitudinal schools. That's what it is that our project is kind of concerned to do. Now, the actual structure of the presentation I want to offer is the structure of a normal scientific project with an abstract, with an introduction that wastes time setting the theoretical context, with the method that looks precisely what it is we're doing, that presents some results, and then tries to draw some conclusions from them. With my undergraduate classes, I always draw attention to the importance of the abstract and say that if the abstract has been written carefully, then you don't really need to stay awake for the rest of the presentation. So I'm going to read you the abstract. The Young People's Attitude to Religious Diversity Project was established to compare the attitudes of students 13 to 15 years of age, educated within the state-maintained sector of schools. I'll emphasise that more later, where church schools and schools without a religious foundation. This is a project in England and Wales, and very much is culturally linked to the way in which the school system works in that place. Not as much data as I would like, but getting on for 2,500 students recruited from England, Wales and London. And I do believe that London ought to be a fifth nation within the UK. I'm looking here at the young people who identify themselves as either no religion or Christian. I've left out of the database those of other faith traditions. That's a different question to address on a different time. I'm controlling for factors that might contaminate what's going on, and I'll talk more about what I mean by that later. Individual differences in personality and religiosity. Then I'm asking, are students attending church schools hold neither a more positive nor less positive attitude towards freedom of religious clothing compared with schools in other non-religious traditions? So that's what it's about. So why am I interested in religious clothing? I'm interested in it because I see it as relevant to the experience of students. I'm not clear if I asked them about the human rights issue, they would be well informed. But I am clear that they are aware of religious differences in the society around them, and particularly in the address and appearance of those who are their peers in schools. That's where they come face to face with the issue. That's what they see. symbols and clothing. What do they make of what they say? Freedom of religious clothing, of course, is a live matter across Europe, and there are a variety of different responses in different nations. But I'm not going to take a lot of time going through the theoretical justification for looking at this particular issue. The Council of Europe, of course, recognises religious clothing and religious symbols as a political matter, a policy matter, a live human rights issue, and even to the point that in 2008 we get a manual on wearing religious symbols in public areas. Because it's written by a Welshman, I thought I ought to just draw attention to the name. It's Evans-y 2008, and Evans 2008 makes some conclusions of what case law is showing, but I'm not going to take time with that. But then you see there's another document from Council of Europe that makes this an educational issue. This is the signpost document, Policy and Practice for Teaching About Religious and Non-Religious Worldviews in Intercultural Education, published in 2014, and of course written by none other than Bob Jackson, who set up the Warwick Religions and Education Research Unit. He pays me only slightly to propagate his work in this way. And chapter 8 of that report, specifically on human rights, and it says one particular issue faced by some young people from religious backgrounds, and also frequently by their parents, is the wearing of religious symbols in public areas such as school. So that in part then is a justification for looking at this issue. A project that many of you may well be familiar with, the REDCO project, run across 8 European countries, in which Bob Jackson was involved and the Warwick Religions and Education Research Unit took its part, but before I joined them. Included in the survey, 2 questions about young people's attitudes towards religious clothing and symbols. And that becomes one of the few studies that we can look to for some real empirical data. But it's empirical data that rests at the level I described earlier of being opinion, not of attitude. I'll share with you the 2 questions. Students should be able to wear religious symbols at school, discreet ones, small crosses, etc., on necklace. Students should be able to wear religious symbols at school, more visible ones, e.g. headscarf. The 2 questions used in the REDCO project. Now, because I've not been part of the REDCO project, I don't have the REDCO data, and any statistics I present can only be presented because I've read the work that come out of the project. And if there's any slight ambiguity in what I present, then it is either because I've misread the material or because it's not clear. Discrete symbols. The percentage of assent that these are acceptable, the top 3 nations. Not a precise figure published for Germany, but it's over 70%. The more visible symbols. Not a precise figure published for Germany. But this is what we learned from the REDCO project, and that was the slim foundation on which I began to build. But why do I bring in the church school issue? I bring in the church school issue because church schools are a real issue within England and Wales. And hear me continually say England and Wales, because those 2 nations, while divided by Offa's Dyke and by political division at the moment, still work very much under the same educational legislation. Scotland, Northern Ireland are indeed a different land. To simply remind you that schools, when they were first built in England and Wales, were not government provided. Voluntary bodies, 1808 the Royal Lancasterian Society, 1811 the National Society. What makes them different? One free church, the other Church of England, and in 1847 the Catholic Poor Schools Committee. All this well underway before in 1870 the Education Act made first provision for schools actually built by the state, entirely sponsored by the state. State money since 1833 was nonetheless being directed to those voluntary societies. So 1870 does not get away with the voluntary spirit, nor the distribution of state funds to those voluntary societies, but creates a state mechanism to work alongside them, to fill the gaps. And that historical context has remained influential. Through to the 1944 Education Act, which provides a new funding mechanism for those church schools. So looking around England and Wales today, you'll find that 1 in 10 secondary school students are educated in schools of a church foundation, and about 1 in 3 primary schools. Quite a lot, and this remains controversial. The Runnymede Trust, which I looked up on the website today just to remind myself what it says about itself, tells me it's the UK's leading independent race equality think tank. Back in 1981, made some significant criticism of church schools. Important stuff. The government report, 1985, the Swan Report, Education for All, was divided over whether church schools should be a benefit or a non-benefit. The majority report made the recommendation that they should cease. The minority report made the recommendation that they should be extended to other faith communities, and particularly mentioned the Islamic community. The Runnymede Trust comes back into play in 2008 with a report called Right to Divide, Faith Schools and Community Cohesion. Their question is whether a school system with faith schools could also promote equality and cohesion. A theoretical question, but one that the Runnymede Trust backed up by some statistics. They had a consultation with over 1,000 people, including parents, pupils, professionals and policymakers from a range of faith backgrounds, as well as those who do not subscribe to any religion. But unfortunately, don't specify quite how that group of people was gathered or what they represent, but at least there's 1,000 of them. And some influential findings. They conclude our research has found that commitment to the promotion of cohesion is not universal, and for many church schools, it's not a priority. Too often there remains a resistance to learning about other faiths when faith schools are seen as spaces in which singular faith identities and traditions are transmitted. And a recommendation. Faith schools are okay because they promote the government's agenda for diversity, but the distinctive contribution of faith schools need to be open to all, and faith schools should no longer admit on faith criteria. So my question, are faith schools, as the Runnymede Trust calls them, church schools as they're generally known, or schools with a religious character, as has become the proper designation since the 1988 Education Reform Act, are they promoting among young people attitudes that are more open or less open? Take this question of freedom of religious clothing. Are these faith schools, church schools, schools with religious character, inclined to bring up young people who have a more closed attitude, a more rejecting attitude to this construct I'm trying to measure, attitude towards freedom of religious clothing? So they're the overall research question. Do students in church schools have a less tolerant attitude to freedom of religious clothing and symbols in schools? How do we measure attitude towards freedom of religion and religious clothing? Well, I gave you my idea at the beginning, and what I have here is the scale of attitude towards freedom of religious clothing and symbols in schools, to which I've given that friendly or somewhat unpronounceable name. I want to test whether it works or not. And it's going to be built up with a range of disparate things that young people are likely to see. Do they hang together to form one attitude scale or not? The second research question, do I need to take control variables into account? Can I assume that the students in the church schools and in the non-church schools are alike on all variables, or do I need a multivariate model that is able to take these factors into account? And if so, what control variables? Inevitably, sex and age. Routine, but not unimportant. But I'm a psychologist, so I'm going to want to bring in my favourite psychological variables. I'm going to bring in IC's personality dimensions. My great friend. Now, the good thing about Ising's personality dimensions is that Ising argues that abnormality is continuous with normality. That within normal people like you, me, Hans Georg, and the rest of us, there are these precipient factors that may be precursors to psychotic disorder. In me, in you, these precursors to what might be neurotic disorder. The distinction between introversion and extroversion. And it's always fun to put in a life scale after all. So let's put those into play and use the Junior Ising Personality Questionnaire revised abbreviated form, because that's the one I constructed and have the copyright on. Religious factors. You're going to get a different degree of religiosity among students in church schools and students not in church schools. What are the factors that count? In this particular analysis, I'm only looking at religious factors. In other analyses, I look at theological factors, but I haven't time to bring those into play today. I'm looking at affiliation. Simply if somebody says, I'm Christian, is there predictive power? But how much more is that predictive power tuned if you look to external behaviour, attendance? Of course, there are lots of constraints on attendance. Forced to go, forced to stay away. But prayer, something that may get slightly closer to the heart of an individual's religiosity, the personal, and the really odd kind of thing that divides different denominations, what they do with the religious text. Then there are location factors. Oddly, religious diversity, and as a consequence, the wearing of religious clothing, is not normally distributed across these three locations of England, Wales and London. You see a bit more in London than you do in England, and there are lots and lots of bits of Wales which are still fairly monochrome. So my third research question, the one I really want to answer, is do church schools make a difference after taking the control variables into account? And employing multi-level linear model to allow for students being nested in schools. I love that word, nested. So the method. Procedure. The Young People's Attitude to Religious Diversity Project, 13 to 15-year-olds, state-maintained schools in England, Wales, London, administered in religious education classes, even got permission from the Ethical Committee with anonymity, confidentiality, and indeed freedom not to participate. Sample, I'm looking at Christians and no religion, that number of students, slightly more in church schools, slight balance to female, equal numbers of year 9 and year 10, 69% taking the affiliation Christian, distributed across those three nations. So what kind of results do I find? The scale. An alpha coefficient of 0.92, a very high internal consistency reliability. I've got confidence that these 10 disparate areas of religious clothing are being assessed by some fairly consistent underlying attitude. The person who says, yes, I see a place for the cross in school, is going to be more likely to say, yes, I see a place for the turban, for the headscarf. They're not working in opposite directions. And what kind of overall response to these individual items? I'll just give you some pictures, but not take too long. So on to research question two. What about these control variables? Are control variables going to be important?
You have 10 more minutes.
10 more minutes, thank you. I shall try not to take more. Control variables, personal factors, sex, the 0.16 with 3 stars, tells me that women are going to be more predisposed towards the acceptance of this construct, freedom of religious clothing. This becomes consistent with a general greater sensitivity, as other data shows, among women rather than men for the religious expression. Age, no significant difference. Having that extra year in school, that extra year of compulsory religious education, is not having a noticeable impact in alienating people any further from religious material. What about the control variables? Are these psychological factors really worth putting into the model? Let's just go back. 6.16, psychoticism, stronger. Neuroticism, extroversion, and just a slight but also statistically significant amount of variance accounted for by the life scale. Put those correlations together and you can begin to account for a significant bit of variance in attitude towards freedom of religious clothing. Social attitudes, of which this is part, are not kind of random things. The kind of people we are, building on Ising's dimensional model of personality, help to predict the kind of views we're going to hold. What about religious factors? Religious affiliation, Christian or not Christian, the label is showing just a slight 5% probability level greater openness, but it's not a powerful predictor. Move into attendance, practicing religion are more powerful than describing oneself by a religious label. But what you can't see here is the extent to which this may be just one thing reflected by three variables, or whether those three variables each contribute an independent additional contribution to the variance, which is why eventually we need to put it into a multivariate model. But these control variables are themselves interrelated. There are sex differences in personality. Women score less highly on psychoticism. This is a male phenomenon. Women score more highly on neuroticism, a female phenomenon. No value, no judgment, but simply seeing how these variables run among men and among women. Social conformity is what the life scale probably measures, and a slight tendency for women to be more likely to say, I'm Christian, but more likely to attend church and to pray. But what about school time? What do we see? No correlation between school time and psychological variables. Going to a church school, you turn out as neither more psychotic, more neurotic, or even more introverted. But there's an enormous correlation between being in a church school and having a religious background. Well, this is one of the reasons for admission, religious criteria. So now we do recognize that we cannot, having seen that religion itself is a predictor of attitudes towards religious clothing, we cannot legitimately explore whether the school makes a difference unless these potential contaminants have been taken into account. And we're nearly at the end. For this is the third research question, employing multi-level analysis, taking the control variables into account, and what is the answer? The school location matters. In London, you're going to have a more positive attitude than in England, and in England, you have a more positive attitude than in Wales. But the school time is not statistically significant. An enormous amount of work to go through to answer a question, but it's a question with this kind of analysis comes up with a different answer from the answer the Runnymede Trust came up with, researching 1,000 people in 2008. What I hope I've done is to make sufficiently clear what I've done in a scientific presentation for others to come on and to be able to replicate what I do. which is one of the problems with the Runnymede Trust. You can't replicate it because you're not told what was done. There's a clear vulnerability to this conclusion because what I shared with you is one dependent variable: attitude to religious clothing and symbols in schools. But I do have other friendly scales within this data set that have assessed attitude to other aspects of religious diversity. And so far, each of the dependent variables I put into this model comes up with the same surprising conclusion. It's a conclusion that will give no joy either to the church that says, we're doing a really good job, we're preparing people better than non-church schools for life in a religiously diverse society, and very little joy for the people on the opposite side who says church schools need to be done away with because they do a rubbish job. And that is the conclusion. What matters? Sex matters, personality matters, religiosity matters, geography matters. What doesn't matter? School time. What questions are raised? Where does the Right to Divide report stand? And what are the implications for the way in which RE might be done in church schools? Thank you.